when you live in a rural area in the United States, like northern Minnesota, like rural Kansas, you get used to the media from urban areas defining you. And the thing is, it isn't an accurate description. No one knows that better than journalist Sarah Smarsh. She has a new book out. It's been called part memoir, part social analysis, and part cultural commentary. It's Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah Smarsh joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Heidi. Glad to be talking with you.
So I'm not even sure where to start, but as you can tell, I get a little PO'd about the definition of rural people from other areas. And of course, though your book is not tied to the elections in 2016, it seemed like it got really heated then and continues to be so of a national media describing rural people. And, you know, to dig deeper into that, a lot of times it relates to being poor, being working class, or living in poverty. And it isn't really what life is actually like. And I wonder if you could kind of talk about that. Let's start with kind of that media definition that gets applied to us.
Sure. Well, the way that I come at this, I think of myself as having what I call a dual class citizenship. So I grew up on a wheat and cattle farm 30 miles west of Wichita, definitely a native of what we might call the working poor of our rural America. And now I'm a journalist whose professional sphere and editors are located in New York City. And so for that reason, I have a particular vantage about the, let's say, the blind spots about class or place. And, of course, those blind spots exist about race and gender and all sorts of things in our most privileged newsrooms. But for me, the corrective that I can kind of provide is to say, well, you might even be very well-intentioned, New York-based reporter, but this framework that you're using for describing an immense swath of the nation is reductive and stereotypical and dwells in caricature. And so, you know, that in the last couple of years has taken a very political tone in assessing the 2016 election. And we hear this term now, a buzzword, really, the rural-urban divide. And you'd think from watching the national news that it's just two essentially different kinds of people in this country, folks out in the rural lands and people in cities. And since I've been both of those things, I know that that is a completely false narrative. Because all of those things are in me, and here I am, just one person, the same integrity and mind and experiences I take wherever I go. So, yeah, I hope the book kind of pushes back against those simplistic stories.
Yeah, even I get asked by people from urban areas, you know, they've envisioned what they think life is like in a rural area. Mm. And it's not to say that there isn't some truth in some of the things, but, you know, it's not all, you know, if we look at it in terms of political parties, it's not all conservative, yeah. It's not all liberal. I mean, it's a very different place than what people have been defining us as.
Absolutely. There's really no hesitation often in painting rural America as a monolith, whether politically, racially, and culturally. You know, you would think from the news that every rural person was a poor, white, conservative male in Appalachia or something. And it's like, as you just suggested, there's diversity of every kind in the rural fabric of America, just like there is in the urban.
Yeah. Well, you have working hard in this subtitle. And I think probably for your family, for the people you grew up with, that was a huge part of character, that you worked hard. I know it defines people who live here as well. I wonder if you can kind of tell us about that legacy of working hard in your family, some of your family members.
Sure. Well, I was born a fifth-generation Kansas farm kid. On my father's side of the family, a lot of wheat farmers, a kind of very stoic German Catholic rural culture. And my dad is also, to this day, actually a construction worker. That was also the family trade. So I grew up on his construction sites in part. And on my mother's side of the family, they were actually not, while like many families in largely agricultural states, they weren't more than a generation removed from the farm in many cases, but my mom's side of the family was really less of a rural bunch. They worked in factories in Wichita. They were very transient, almost nomadic, all over the Midwest, waiting tables in truck stop diners and having hard luck lives as women. And so, you know, every single person that I come from is defined by the intensity and the necessity of their labor throughout their lives. For the women among them, I'm talking about doing hard work long before the decade that the show Mad Men would suggest women entered the workforce. The women I come from have been working all along, and they still are today. And my book is trying to get at the inequities of our labor system. But that is not to say that I'm against hard work. In fact, I love it and I relish it and I thrive in it. It's just sort of how I was bred, I guess. My issue is never with hard work. It's with whose work is valued and devalued in a kind of unfair labor system.
Let's talk about the women in particular. Your mom was a teenager when she had you. Was your grandma a teenager too when she had your mom?
Yeah. Yes. So I mentioned that I'm a fifth generation farm kid on my dad's side. The legacy that I inherited on my mother's side has to do with teen pregnancy. So when I was researching the book, as far back as I could find in any records, so as far back as records were kept, I am the first female in my direct maternal line to not have a child as a teenager. And, you know, I sensed that at a very young age, and I knew, of course, I didn't understand how, but I knew it had something to do with the economic outcomes of our family and the women in it, and some of the limitations that they faced. Now I can, you know, articulate in some ways that, well, poverty makes motherhood harder and motherhood makes poverty harder. And these were things I sensed as a kid, and I knew from a very early point in life that I wanted to make sure I did not continue that cycle.
We're talking with Sarah Smarsh today. Her new book is out. It's on the New York Times bestseller list, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. A lot of times, especially in rural areas, you can get isolated as you were growing up. Mm. Was there a feeling, did you know there wasn't quite enough money or that people were working harder than maybe other people might be?
Yeah. No, this is such a good question because I think the way that we see ourselves and the way that we define our own experiences is so important. And maybe it's because in my 1980s childhood and then I was a teenager in the 90s, my class and place still did not have things like cable TV and computers and internet, even as the middle class was moving into this kind of digital era that we're in. And so for that reason, I didn't really, I didn't have like a constant barrage of messages or images telling me who I was in the context of American socioeconomic order. So that's a long way of saying I had no idea we were poor. And I think that if I'd been a kid today with a, you know, even poor rural kids have smartphones now, to some extent, I might have gleaned more from popular culture that we were bad off. But maybe it was a blessing that I did not have that understanding. I never in a million years would have used the word poor about my family's experience. Now, I knew that we worked, even within the context of the working class, I understood at a young age that we were on a kind of lower end in terms of resources. So if I was hanging out with my friends who were from working class families, they had a little change for a pop and candy at lunch, and I didn't. So, you know, class is such a relative experience. Within pecking orders, there are pecking orders. So I had a vague sense that my family didn't have much, but I wouldn't have used the word poor. Turns out that word is entirely accurate, though.
So what was life like in rural Kansas in the 1980s and 90s in terms of the economics of the entire country? How did it hit there?
Well, the 80s, of course, was when the farm crisis that we talk about today was first really coming to a head. Under the policy of that era, there were, and I would say just the extreme industrialization and corporatization of what had previously been a whole bunch of family farms across the country meant that places like where I was from were full of farms going under. And so I sensed that all around me. You know, the small towns still were, I wouldn't go so far as to say thriving. They were in economic decline by the time I was a child, but there was still, you know, like the grocery store on Main Street and the small town hospital and some of the very small schools that have since consolidated. Now a lot of those businesses have shuttered in just a few decades of my lifetime. But at that moment, I could sense that I was already receiving messages that if I wanted to do the things that I meant to do as an ambitious kid, I wasn't going to be able to do them in my home. And that was a painful realization for me because I was never a kid who wanted to, quote-unquote, get out. I love where I'm from, and I live, right now I'm talking to you, 30 miles from that farm that I grew up on. But my coming of age sort of happened in tandem with what I would call really the demise of the rural working class. It's not to suggest they aren't still fighting like hell, and many of them have hung on to their farms against all odds, but it certainly hasn't gotten any easier in the last 30 years.
Well, I mentioned that your book has been described as a lot of things, and it is part memoir, and very selfishly, I would love to hear about your grandma Betty. I loved reading about her.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us. Yeah.
She's pretty cool, isn't she? What can I tell you?
She's a strong lady, and she had a lot of relationships and a lot of work, and was you spent a lot of time with her. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, well, to go back to the cycle of teen pregnancy you mentioned, that meant that she became a grandma to me when she was all of 34 years old.
Wow.
And so for that reason, in some ways, she was kind of a second mother to me, and that's a pretty common feature of families from my same kind of economic class. So I actually moved in with her fairly permanently when I was 11 years old. And so for that reason, and, you know, all the while I maintained a close relationship with my mother, but for various reasons and involving stability and money, that was the right place for me to dwell permanently. And so I deeply admired her as a kid and understood that she was just tough as nails, funny, sassy broad that was also a very kind and maternal person. So she's kind of the matriarch of our family in that she's the one that helps people when they're in a bind. In spite of a severely abusive and chaotic upbringing, she kind of summoned her own decency and strength to emerge as really a caretaker for others. And I know, you know, there are so many people like that in who come from the hardest of circumstances, and they often are unsung and unseen in the national story about poverty that tends to paint it as this miserable experience of full of wretches. And so for me, one of the goals of the book is to dignify strong women like her who, you know, as far as I'm concerned, are the backbone of this country in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I had a grandmother who always told me, you know, you needed a stash of money just in case. You know, you never know what's going to happen. You might need to run away from your husband. You might need to just to give yourself a little bit of stability. Always have that little backup there. And I always took that to heart, I guess.
Yeah, love that.
So I want to talk about, I read an interview you did with Publishers Weekly, and I just love the way you handled this question. So you were asked about shame and whether it prevented poor people from having a social movement. And your answer was very clear. You said more powerful than shame is in one's potential action is a lack of understanding to the extent to which you are getting screwed. And I just thought, that's it. That's it exactly. It's not that people are not bright that are living in small towns or who are poor, but it is this whole system that doesn't address them.
Sure. You know, I think that when we talk about civic disengagement or even apathy in relation to voting or protests or activism, one piece is often left out of that puzzle is just that all of that sort of activity requires resources like time and sometimes money that a lot of people I come from don't have. But then even beyond that, if one were going to prioritize such action, whether it be organizing for worker rights or canvassing for a candidate who truly represents your interests. That would require a sense of a sense that your own vote and action matters. And if you've lived your whole life having your labor devalued, your paychecks are too low for the work you've given, your body is busted and you can't afford to go to the hospital, this society is telling you that you don't matter. And so it's not hard to see that someone might extrapolate from that, well, my voice and my vote don't matter either. And God, when you're bone tired from work and you have a couple extra hours, maybe you're going to understandably spend it watching the tube instead of out fighting for change. And then the second part of that is, as you were saying from the Publishers Weekly interview, it would also require a real sense of grievance and complaint that I think sometimes just the psychological function of survival requires that we, I wouldn't say sugarcoat our circumstances, and my family certainly never did, but just getting up every morning, putting one foot in front of the other, requires that you hold on to an almost irrational hope about your life and maybe tomorrow is going to be better. And if you are just by necessity kind of dwelling in that psychological framework, it's very hard to simultaneously look at the harsh truths of your situation and how severely negative they might be. For that matter, that requires piecing together all sorts of information that is often artfully hidden from the people who are being disadvantaged within this system. So it's just a whole lot of forces at work against any individual who would potentially be out fighting for better conditions.
I mentioned that Heartland is on the New York Times bestseller list. That's got to feel great. Why do you think people are responding?
Oh, gosh. It does feel great. You know, I think that one piece of the puzzle is that what I have written is not a political argument or an attempt to say I'm right and someone else is wrong about the way that this country should run. Rather, while I certainly have ideas about public forces and policy, I'm ultimately just trying to paint a picture of human beings and the way that their private lives dovetail with public decisions made by more powerful people. And that is an experience that people, whether they're rural or urban, black, white, or brown, even middle class and in a society that is right now economically distressing for just about everyone other than the wealthy, that everyone can relate to in some sense. It's been very heartening to be on this book tour I've been on the last few weeks, and people of all stripes come through the line and say, my story is different than yours, and yet it's the same. And I think the sameness is in the work and the sense that there is some sort of inherent injustice or unfairness about the current economic structure.
The book is called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. You can find more information at sarahsmarsh.com. Sarah, it was great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Heidi, this was great. Thank you.